Don't waste a second coding yet another login registration system. Use Product Structure to dynamically provide your site with turnkey solutions for user engagement, all through a single line of JavaScript. From registration to importing contacts to inviting friends, our products come with a built-in A/B testing engine to ensure you have the best methods to manage your users. Product Structure. Focus on your core application and let us serve you the rest.
Come to Chicago Airline Factory Light on October 4th and listen to airline talks from Alexander Gunaris, Susan Potter, Adam Densberg, Christopher Meckeljohn, Evan Miller, Mahesh Mahalani Subramaya, Garrett Smith, Corey Haynes, Jesse Gum, and Sean Cribbs. Use the discount code MOSTLYAirline to get a 15% discount when you register on the Airline Factory website.
Hello and welcome to the Mostly Airline podcast, episode number 12. And today we're talking about scaling Erlang and how are we going to deal with the truly monstrous systems that are coming down the pipe when we have, you know, not 8 or 16 cores, but 1,000 or 100,000 or 1,000,000. So today we have on our panel Francesco Cesarini.
Hi, Francesco. Founder, technical director of Erlang Solutions, O'Reilly Offer, and general troublemaker.
Fred Haber.
Hi, I'm Fred. I work in the Heroku routing team, and I wrote Learn Using Erlang for Great Good.
Henry Nystrom.
I work in Campania, and I've worked with Erlang, since 96, basically, and seen the most, among other things, working as a consultant for Erlang Solutions earlier.
And I'm Zach Kessen, author of Building Web Applications with Erlang. And like I said, today we're talk about scaling Erlang. But before we get to that, we have any announcements? We got Erlang Camp coming up in Nashville at the end of August.
We've got September 14th. We've just completed the program for the Erlang Factory Light in San Francisco.
New York.
Thanks. So the Erlang Factory Light in New York, and there's an amazing lineup of speakers. Includes Fred here on the call today. Robert Verding, Joe Armstrong, Mahesh, Adam Denenberg from the Huffington Post, and lots of other speakers. So not to be missed on Saturday 14th. And the actual conference itself is preceded by 3 days of training by Erlang co-inventor Robert Verding. So
sounds amazing. We also got a couple others. So we got month after that is Chicago, I believe, and then Berlin and Tel Aviv. So all three of them will be amazing, great programs. So if you're close to any of those cities or would like to travel, please do. Call for proposals for Tel Aviv is still open. I'm not sure about the others, but if you have a need to give a talk or it's a topic you want to present, I'm sure there are plenty of opportunities coming up. Okay, so we have currently, we have systems with 4 cores. My laptop here has 4 cores. There are chips out there that have 16 and 32 cores, I guess. IBM has some giant servers that have 16-core chips. But I get the impression that pretty soon we're not going to have 16 cores, but, 1,000 cores or something.
I'd like to add, very soon you'll be able to get, from the Parallela board from Adaptiva, 64 cores consuming 3 watts of energy at the size of a Raspberry Pi.
Cool. I mean, that sounds like it'd be worth playing with for,
Absolutely.
It's the processing is, the cores are there and you need a concurrent language and we happen to have one. So the first question is, as of today, when we're recording this, how well does Erlang do when you hit it with a large number of cores for whatever we call large? How well does Erlang do when you do 16 cores?
So it does fairly well. I think what we've been discovering when we try to scale it on many cores are actually bottlenecks in the system. But the scalability from 2 cores to 4 cores, it will usually go twice as fast from 4 cores to 8 cores the same. But what we've been discovering through the recent studies are just bottlenecks in the system itself, which, will stop the scalability to a certain level of cores. I mean, there was a great talk in San Francisco by Concurix about this, where, they found the bottlenecks in Chicago BOS, and having removed the bottlenecks, they got, the scalability to kind of skyrocket until they hit the next bottleneck.
Right, and I suspect there's a fair number of bottlenecks that you're only going to find when you start rolling out those boards. And
exactly. I mean, you need a whole kind of slightly different mind shift when you start programming for, you know, many core systems, and you need to start thinking about bottlenecks. Prior to that, when you had one or two cores, even four cores, it wasn't that big of an issue. I usually detected the bottlenecks, you know, through a long message queue. It becomes a bit harder when you start dealing with many core machines. And machines, you know, we're talking 32, 64, 128 cores, and so on.
What's the most number of cores in a machine you can get sort of realistically right now?
I'm not sure, but many, many, many. I'd say in the hundreds of thousands.
Okay. I mean, I know IBM has the one of their sort of mid-range servers, you know, sort of the million-dollar size of a refrigerator kind of deals that has like 1,024 cores in it. But I suppose it sort of depends on what you mean by in one machine as well.
Exactly. And I think that's really where it starts getting interesting, because, you know, we've got multi-core happening, but, you know, multi-core is actually, and then that's something I've rarely seen people speak about, actually goes hand in hand with distribution. There's no point in spanning a program over a million cores. What you do is you'll have many programs spanning over, well, a certain number of cores, and then you use distributed Erlang to connect them.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. So, Henry, it sounds like you've been done a lot of work on this front.
I've been doing some. It was interesting thinking about when Francesco was saying that we have to also go towards distribution, also in the one system locally. And in fact, if I don't remember incorrectly, that was the way it was done originally, before we had good support for multicore in the Erlang VM. So when the first trials were done, they actually ended up quite often when they had multiple CPUs going distributed rather than trying to use, the earliest versions of the threaded one. It was actually better performance doing distributed in the first instances. Of course, that was long way before they started doing all the optimization they're doing now with lock contention and so on, because that's where you really have to scale it, and it's very, very hard to remove all the bottlenecks. And also, quite often, you will end up with locality in your system, so you want to make it distributed. And, of course, if you can build your system so that works well with having multicore and also distributed, then when you have to go off ship, you have to basically have more machines, because even if you scale up with more cores, you will have to go distributed. So it's good having that distinction in your system from the start, and also being able to deal with it.
I want to correct you there, or not correct you, but just add something. And it's not, you'll go distributed on the same machine as well. I mean, we'll be seeing machines with millions of cores in our lifetime, and how do you scale on those?
That's what I was thinking. You will have to do that already on the same machine. And then when you go to several, well, if you already have a good pattern for that, that will actually be very, very simple.
Yeah.
And that's what I've seen many systems where it comes to scalability. One of the problems you run into is the good support you have make you, less aware that you actually have to consider this more. So it's so easy going from just a concurrent system with perhaps using several cores to go to distributed, and you don't invest enough in your system when it comes to dealing with the fact that you're going to have radically different latencies and so on between different parts, depending if it's distributed or just concurrent.
The failure model starts to merge or converge at that point too, because if you have, I don't know, three or four cores, the likelihood that one of them is going to fail in this month is relatively low. But if you have thousands of them, then the probability that there's going to be an entire failure in some part of your system at that point, even at the hardware level, is going to shoot up, generally speaking.
Yeah,
you have to start thinking about that, and you get to have similar problems to what you have in distributed systems anyway.
Or like a core on the, core number 73 on a chip might.
Yeah, it, It shut down or something. I mean, it happens right now with sometimes things like hyper-threading, and we've had server applications at my old job at AdGear where the OS just decided to shut down half of the cores all of a sudden. And then you lost a lot of power, and things started being unresponsive, and that wasn't a 16-core machine. Yeah. And you needed to hard reboot it to get the cores back or something like that. So it's just going to happen more and more the more cores you had. It's basic probability.
Well, we're probably also going to have, when we have in the, you know, large number of cores, that it detects if you have a bad core. Just as you deal with bad sectors and disks today, that you shut one down because it's bad. But you don't want to chuck it all out because one in a million is gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at that point, isolation becomes interesting to have. If it's about memory or whatever, because you're going to have to duplicate everything in the computer just to fit more inside or something, I guess.
It requires sort of different levels of logic. The other thing is, of course, you know, we tend to do our development on lightly loaded systems that are just, you know, running test loads. And that's hard to sort of do that mental mapping, for me at least, where, you know, I'm used to dealing with, we're doing most of my development with, you know, just the only load on the machine is my testing it. And of course, when you get into, you know, this million core machines, you're assuming it's going to have a million cores worth of work. Otherwise, why bother? And, you know, how do you design your algorithms and your architecture such that Amdahl's law and other things like that don't bite you when you start, you know, getting up to a million machines and suddenly you discover that, you know, half your system is swamped completely, the other half is sitting there doing nothing. And I don't have an answer for that.
Well, I think, ideas are coming up now, but looking at, you know, how, you know, if you've got a bottleneck, and I mean, one of the ideas, I don't remember who it was who implemented it, but was, you know, they had a lot of dynamic, I think it was Russia implemented, they had a lot of dynamic children, which they were adding to a supervisor. And the supervisor still uses list was proving to be a huge bottleneck. What they did was they moved from one supervisor to a pool of supervisors, and that allowed them to scale everything. And, you know, I think it's very much the same principle to, you know, which one should be dealing with when dealing with multi-core. You've got one service, and how that service is implemented in the background should be hidden, and it should be able to scale up if it proves, you know, to be the bottleneck, and you should use some form of consistent or dynamic hashing to ensure that, you know, certain requests which have to be realized are always get sent, you know, to the same process.
Yeah, something like RIAC Core, we're actually doing an episode on that scheduled for next month, so look forward to that, guys. So now, there's this thing, the release project, Erlang Solutions is involved, and there's a lot of EU funding and Uppsala University, and I'm looking at lots of other things going through the partners. So what's the goal of the release project?
So the release project looks at two things. It looks at three things. And what we're doing is, down on the low level, it looks at getting the Erlang VM to scale to as many cores as possible. Then you've got the layer on top of it, which is the distributed layer. How do you connect together distributed nodes, and then there's a third part which has to do with toolings and tool sets and tool chains, which, you know, are very different to the one you deal with when you're dealing with conventional architectures. So I think, you know, that's release, the elevator pitch of the release project.
And when did it get started, and sort of who are the principal people behind it?
So it started, I'd say, about 2 years ago. It got about €3.5 million in funding. And, you know, the principal people behind it include Glasgow University, originally Harriet Watt, Ericsson, Erlang Solutions, Uppsala University, and EDF, so Electricité de France, and the Institute of Communications and Computer Systems in Athens, and the University of Kent.
Okay, so it's all...
It's a European-funded project, that's correct, by the EU, part of the EU STREP FP7 framework. And it's a mixture of academic and industrial, it's a consortium of academics and industrial users.
And is it produced stuff that, you know, can be used and we would find, you know, that us practitioners would find useful today?
Absolutely. I mean, they've been looking at, you know, there've been a lot of talks at the Erlang User Conference on, you know, log3s tables, for example, on metrics, on improvements, tools as well. So a lot of it is going straight back into the ecosystem. We're seeing the results already today.
So I'm seeing that dialyzer is in part of it.
Yes. So parallel, you know, the parallelized dialyzer is part of it, for example.
And Precept 2, which was that the one they had us put on the 3D glasses at EUC?
Oh, no, no, that's another one. That was performance. But Precept 2 basically shows you how the processes migrate from one runtime queue to another runtime queue across cores.
Okay.
You know, you try to balance across, you know, across multiple cores.
So, and there's also, I'm looking at this at the website, Bench Earl, which I guess is a benchmarking tool. So, yeah, dialyzer is sort of a standard part of my workflow now. I just wish it ran a little faster on my code base, but that's probably a product of my laptop more than anything else. It saved me a lot of headaches, and we'll talk more about that in a future episode as well.
Henry, you're a companion. I've got a question for you. How do you guys scale? Because I mean, we're now talking about the future. We're talking about a million cores, and we're talking about. But what is it you guys do to actually get your system to scale? You've been very successful as a company. You're growing very quickly.
Well, we've taken a completely different route, actually, since we are based completely in the Amazon EC2 cloud, Well, as you may be aware, there are rather varying qualities when it comes to performance in, particularly networking. So we don't, in fact, use distributed Erlang terribly much. What we do is we have broken up our system into services, more like a service bus architecture, but more simplistic actually at the moment, but we're working more towards a bus architecture so that we can have small, rather weak instances, but they do part of the job. So if one falls out, it's fairly easy to replace them. And just having huge numbers of them instead. And that's the thing I was thinking of building systems to live with faults, which we do now. You have to have a certain amount of redundancy and be prepared to actually do job twice just to be sure that one of them succeeds. I was intrigued I was thinking, we discussed earlier Parallella, which I find an absolutely fascinating platform. I've got several of my colleagues that are raring to buy them and try out, among other things, Erlang on them. And that was
since April.
Yeah. And those kind of platforms really stress that we need better tool support as well, since they aren't uniform anymore. We have the 16 cores code chip on there, but we also have the dual cores of the ARM. And one would really like to be able to use both parts fully. And that really requires good tool support, since the properties won't be the same.
All right. And Fred, you're at Heroku, so clearly you guys, scale is something you guys probably know quite a bit about, because it seems like...
Yeah, but I mean, it's still going to be similar to what Henry mentioned, being an EC2 and everything like that. And in our case, it's really scaling horizontally on multiple machines. So a lot of it is about making sure that we have fast update with reasonable consistency without actually dropping the fault tolerance. This is an interesting challenge to have, because usually you have to pick between them, and so you have to carefully pick your trade-offs into what you can tolerate and can't tolerate. But most of the work, yeah, is actually about being able to spread the data to have up-to-date information quickly enough on the entire platform that the error rate remains acceptable. because what I'm working on at Heroku is mostly routing either logs or HTTP requests. So a lot of it is just sharing configurations and make sure that everything is, the entire global state is fine over dozens or hundreds of nodes, depending on the subsystem.
And how do you distribute all that information around? You know, what do you guys use?
Some of them, let's say Logplex, I'm going to talk about that one because it's open sourced, is using, at the moment, it's using Redis databases and an application in Erlang called NSYNC. And basically, we push all the writes to the Redis instances, and the Erlang nodes themselves pretend to be Redis nodes that want to have chain replication or some kind of replication pushed to them. And so we use the Redis node as a master and then just stream the updates to all the other Erlang nodes that pretend to be a Redis database and converts them back to something local in ETS tables. So for that system, that's how it works. For other systems, we have usually something kind of similar where you have a leader and that one orders the updates and makes sure that the view is consistent. So you can just use snapshots and catch up on whatever work you were doing. It's the easiest right now at a given scale, but I don't know how far it's going to scale in the future, though.
Sounds like it's, yeah, sounds like I get some challenges ahead of me because I'm working for a startup and we are using Erlang, but currently our entire service is running on one EC2 node, and it's not even a particularly large one because we've only rolled out to two or three customers at this point, so we're kind of in the early phase.
I mean, the most basic problem is being able to work on two nodes. That's where you have to split all your memory, make sure that the basic stuff is not blocking. And then as you scale up, then you get into other problems regarding performance, latency, and whatnot. But it takes a while before you get there in general, I think.
Right.
So you basically have the fun stuff waiting for you.
Yeah, well,
when it gets really interesting.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast. I wanted to know, as I'm building my system for, you know, on one node and two nodes when it's small, you know, what are the things I need to look out for? What should I be paying attention to so that when I get to 25 nodes, which hopefully will be sooner rather than, you know, soonish, I'm not pulling my hair out.
It's hard. Yeah, go ahead, Henry.
Sorry. One of the major things is plan for it ahead. Start thinking about how you will let errors propagate through your system. How can you contain them, basically? How far can they reach? So that if you have one error somewhere, what will it affect? And trying to minimize that, because that is the one that is going to cause you the most pain. That with either direct real errors or just getting slowed down in parts of your system. One of the things you will, for example, find is that you occasionally will just go and kill instances because they are bad. We had one out of, I think we had 20 servers running the same instance, performing the same role, and we had one generating almost all the log items, having problems, not being able to keep up and so on. And we just replaced it and all that went away. There are lots of things like that you have to deal with when living in the cloud because they aren't uniform in real life.
Right. You like to pretend that all your EC2 instances are uniform, but
yeah,
it's clearly not the case. The question I thought about is obviously there are different sizes and types of EC2 instances. You've got, you know, smaller and larger and disk-oriented ones and memory-oriented ones and stuff. When is it better to pick, you know, when would I be better off using three medium instances versus, you know, one larger instance or one of the high-memory instances or something like that? I mean, sort of what do people think about that?
I guess usually is when you can get the same performance for less money. That's when you want to switch. It's usually that simple when it comes to a business. You try it with fewer machines, and if you see similar performances, but you end up paying less money to do it, then you do that. I think it's usually the easiest optimization for a business at that point.
Right.
For example, Netflix saw great savings when they could move on to the high-speed SS2 disk-based ones. So they could... They were considerably more expensive than the ones they replaced, but I think they got a ratio like, what was it, 1 to 4, 1 to 5? So they can just could use throw away bin, you know, loads of them, which meant that they reduced the overall cost and actually had better performance in the entire system, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, one thing I have done so far, although it's sort of still in an amateur, you know, I won't say amateurish, but primitive state, is I have a little script that downloads yesterday's web machine performance logs and then pipes them into R and produces some plots of, you know, just so I know which parts of our system are, you know, which API calls are running slow, because I'm in charge of our company's API. It's not, you know, hugely sophisticated, but it gets the job. But for now, at least, it gets the job done, and I can just see if anything is running too slowly. And R is, of course, a wonderful tool for doing all sorts of statistical and number crunching kind of stuff, even if I don't really understand it.
Well, there you hit upon one thing that we've come across specifically. A general point, but it crops up with Web Machine. Web Machine doesn't have a good way of saying, no, I can't handle more. As you know, you don't set in a limit. You will accept this many connections.
Right. I mean, you can and do that's, it, you have to do it manually.
Yeah. And
no, I agree. I think, yeah, go ahead, Henry. No.
Yeah. And the thing we've seen is that, no surprise to me, actually, you have to always be able to limit how much work you accept, because otherwise you will have that, particularly when you work in a cloud where you have actual different properties of the machines, which you can't really observe except for when they're lagging behind, is that one get completely swamped, and that degrades the entire system. So you have to be able always to set limits that, okay, I can actually do, say, 2,000 simultaneous requests. I can't do more, and I will actually decline to accept more than that.
And right. This is a fairly recent issue. You know, in the past, we were running bank on a single core machine. We'd stress test it, and you'd be either memory bound or CPU bound. And you know, so you'd hit the machine until it started running 100% CPU, and one after the other, you removed the bottlenecks. That was not, you know, that stopped the case with more, where all of a sudden you started running into a lot of other issues. So OS related issues, IO starvation, network congestion, and really that's where load regulation came in. So, you know, they always had it in telecom systems. This telecom system would be pushed extremely hard, but other systems, it's something relatively new, you know, to the wider airline world. And, you know, we actually dedicated a whole track at the Airline User Conference in June this year. So yeah, posted the link here. Well, and I mean, there's some really interesting talks over how, you know, how Bash should do it, how, and also, you know, two load regulation tools from Jesper Lewis Anderson and Fieger, which allow, well, which are, you know, fairly new on the market as well.
Yeah, I mean, because basically, you what you can do is you can very easily have in that first decision point in the web machine graph there something that does a load check, and it can return a 503 not available if things are above a certain limit. Which you know, and of course, then the question is, how do you define what is too much load? And that's a, you know, probably an empirical thing more than anything else. And as you say, you sort of have to be, I don't know how you know, you can't just say X requests per minute, because different EC2 instances, even of the same type, will have different, subtly different performance.
Yeah.
So this is always an option when we're discussing load. It's always about how many requests you can accept. But a fun one that we tend to see a lot, at least at Heroku with the logs and everything, is that you can't tell someone, well, your application can no longer log right now, slow down your application. And so you have this kind of deal with load, which is equivalent to building a dam on a river, which is at some point you can't block what's coming to you. You have to shed load on yourself. And it's about deciding, when do you drop request kind of silently, how do you report the losses and everything, but it's not always about blocking or slowing down people. It's just about generally being able to say, well, the toilet can take more crap, So either drop it on the site or tell someone to stop crapping in the toilet.
Or quickly start building more toilets. You know, this is the one advantage of EC2, is at least theoretically, depending on where your load is, you know, hitting, you can bring up three more. You can always bring up a couple more nodes. Assuming your budget.
Absolutely. But there's normally a limit to that and also how fast you can do it. And what I was thinking when just web machine, of course, you can build something into your state flow. But the problem, I've seen is that you already want to say, and as Fred was saying, shedding out the interface, basically stop accepting. Because the thing is, even saying no when you have systems that start thrashing a bit can be too much. I mean, that's a classical telco technique again. And as with many of those things, when we come to really high loads and high availability systems, we have to go running back to the telecom techniques because they've been dealing with it for 100 years now.
Well, I just remember when I was first an undergrad in university, the university had a big server that was a HP Unix machine. And one of the things they did was they disallowed users from using the top program, which shows you, you know, what's loading down the system. Because they discovered whenever the system got too loaded, everybody started spinning up top to see what was going on. And then suddenly the main problem on the system was everybody was running top. So they wouldn't let you do that. So I think how do you provide back pressure to regulate your load is in a web machine or in other tools. I don't know, does Cowboy or some or Yaws have a better system for this?
I think we will see in the future more and more intelligent, so to speak, load balancing support. Because what we really need to do is really good back pressure so we don't have to say no, no, no 1,000 times because we're getting 1,000 more requests than we get. We say no once, we're really in trouble here. And the load distribution part actually backs off from that instance for a while.
Right. I don't know yet know enough about how the Amazon load balancer really works to...
You can't do anything like that, as far as I know.
The Amazon load balancer is pretty much similar to HAProxy in general. So it's a rather dumb balancer that does round robin, one request per instance, and that's about it. And a few health checks coming in from time to time to make sure that you're able to accept requests. And that's pretty much what it does, as far as I know.
But there's no way.
And that's why if someone falls behind, it gets more behind because it gets hammered as often as the rest. And since that one is getting timeouts, the others get hammered more and you get this sort of snowball effect.
Right. What you really want is a way to start returning 503s and to bring up more nodes and sort of be able to have a strategy of saying, when we start hitting load limits, you know, execute this code path to do something about it, which could be bring up more nodes or something.
There is research being done on that topic. I'm linking to research by Microsoft. It's the algorithm called Join Idle Queue, which is basically the big downside of that one is that all the instances receiving data have to know about all the load balancers. And what you do is that when you're free, you contact one of the load balancers in random and tell it, you can send me work. At that point, it's a token system that makes it so that you don't get overloaded, but it requires cooperation between the load balancer and the actual worker, which is hard to do for a platform like EC2 where you don't know what you're going to contact outside of its HTTP or TCP. So you need usually to build your own kind of load balancer that's a bit smarter or something to be able to do that kind of balancing.
I think one of the things we'll be seeing very much right now is if you look at defined networking and also more specifically is the ability to solve this problem on a networking level. So you've got controllers which information on the traffic and these controllers will then set up lists between specific machines to basically how can you put it, to basically go in and optimize throughput of your data. and doing something similar for hardware and for computing, I think, is very much on the books in the near future.
Yeah, I think we've got some interesting stuff coming down the pipe. It's just going to be a couple of years till it lands on our servers, or maybe it won't be. I don't know.
But, I mean, one of the projects we're working on at Airline Solutions internally as part of the release project is something called Wombat, which allows you to deploy to heterogeneous clouds. And the idea there is that you scale, based on capabilities. So you're noticing that, you're running on a small instance on Amazon, but that you've been running at a certain level of CPU utilization for the last hour. Move that service to a larger instance on Amazon.
Can it also go the other way and realize
exactly.
You have a large instance that's running at 4% and you'd be much better off?
You've got 10 servers, they've been running at 20% CPU, shut half of them down. And, but interesting here is that it's completely target agnostic. So your cluster could consist of parallel boards running alongside Amazon and Rackspace instances. So completely abstracting away, the end target and that intelligence in the system itself.
I mean, the other thing I sort of want to bring up is there's the guys doing the Erlang on Zen project where they're actually trying to run Erlang directly on the hypervisor. I actually would like to get them on the show at some point. So if you guys are listening, please drop me a line and we'll try to set up a date and a time. But, they have startup times in the order of, milliseconds. And I don't really know a lot about it in terms of how compatible it is with regular distributed Erlang and other stuff. But it's certainly an interesting idea that Erlang sort of is an OS in and of itself, so why run it on top of BSD or Linux or Solaris? Why not just run it on the hypervisor? And then you have a much faster start time, which certainly would give you some elasticity issues for some things.
It's an interesting set of problems they're solving. They're not the types of problems we've been solving in the Erlang community.
Right. Which is fine. It's just...
Absolutely, absolutely. They're bringing Erlang to new markets, which is great.
I don't know. There's a lot of details about it I don't know. And I know it's not open source, and I'm not sure it's just equally compatible. They had a demo where they would show it where you'd make a request, it would spool up an Erlang VM, deal with your web request, and then shut it down again, which seemed kind of silly to me. I didn't seem like a lot of reason for that. It seemed kind of overkill. You could just do that in a process in an existing Erlang VM. But it was a cool demo.
It completely depends on the types of problems you need to solve. I mean, to quote Joe Armstrong, if you're going to start up systems which will run for decades without being taken down, does it matter to take a few seconds to start? I mean, this was on the mailing list. Someone's trying to use Erlang as a scripting language and complaining that it took a few seconds. So it's completely, problem dependent. What problem are you trying to solve?
Right.
Give us a solution for that. And it's,
On the other hand, if you have a system where I can imagine a system where the system as a whole needs to run for years on end, but you may want to bring up and down individual nodes over a very short time span to deal with traffic that's coming in sort of in bursts, where you have, 3x your normal traffic for 10 minutes. Maybe because your marketing department put an ad in the Super Bowl or something, and that's going to last 5 minutes or a few hours or something, and they go back to normal, where the ability to bring up nodes very, very fast could be very valuable, even if your main system is just sort of conventional EC2 nodes running conventional Erlang.
Also gives you the ability to have not only to have more load, but it can also use sacrifice nodes when you need that. Nodes that you can allow to fail. For example, if you want to run LinkedIn drivers and other things that you would like to protect yourself from, but you really need those for, say, performance, but you only want to spin them up, do their stuff, and let them go away.
Right.
It could be you're running third-party C code you want to LinkedIn, but you don't want to link it into your main system, since if that goes belly up, everything goes belly up, and you want to have a sacrifice node for a while, then spinning one up very quickly can actually be quite nice.
I hadn't thought of that. Mostly because I haven't written any C code since, I don't want to say. It's been a long time. I don't think I could write C code today if I had to. Sounds like there's a lot to talk about. I think we'll have to come back to this subject in the future, probably when I... if people have specific questions about scaling, when we put this on, put leave comments on the blog, and when we come back and do another scaling episode, which I'm sure at some point we will, when we're scheduled, we'll try to get to them.
That's the only way to cover this subject. You have to scale it out.
Yeah, and you know, I sort of find out. And if you look on our blog, we have on a calendar, it shows these sort of planned upcoming episodes, and while they may or may not always happen exactly as, you know, as listed, if people have sort of suggestions, comments, questions about upcoming episodes, please tweet at me or tweet at some of the other regulars here, and or email or whatever, and we'll try to make sure that they get, you know, answered, because this really isn't, you know, this podcast is designed to sort of benefit everybody and bring the knowledge to, you know, answer people's questions. So, also, if people are trying to hire Erlang programmers or other people in the Erlang community, please feel free to send me an email and we'll announce it. Francesco, are you looking to hire anybody you want to announce any open positions?
We're hiring, yes. We're hiring good Erlang programmers, enthusiastic people who like challenges and customer projects. And we're also looking for business development people in the U.S. at the moment.
So, yeah, if you have Erlang jobs, we'd like to come, you know, people, I don't want people to say, well, there are no jobs in Erlang, so why should I learn it? So we would like to announce them.
Well, then I can also pitch in that Campania has been recruiting quite, should I say, aggressively. We will probably have a bit of a lull period again, but we never know how long that lasts.
And those jobs would be in Stockholm?
That would mainly be in Stockholm, yes. Okay. But we do help relocations.
Okay.
There are about 20 to 30 jobs, I think, including Campania's, posted on the Erlang Central job board. So feel free to have a look and ping them. You know, everything from Boston, San Francisco, Seattle, Stockholm to South Africa. So.
Sounds good. All right. So why don't we get to the picks and wrap it up? Francesco, you have any interesting links or picks for this week?
Yes. One is, it's the flowforwarding.org website, which is an open flow. It's an open source switch, which implements the open flow version 1.2 and 1.3.1 and OAuthConfig 1.1, which, you know, I think open flow and software defined networking is where, you know, it's going to be heading. So it's interesting, and it's available and running today.
Henry?
None that I can think of at the moment, unfortunately.
Fred, you got anything interesting?
Yeah, I got a few of them. Well, two. First one is I'm going to be participating in an O'Reilly webcast that's called Modern Server Application Design with Erlang. And it's going to be something kind of interactive where I'm going to sit around and try to design a tiny system in Erlang for a server application in a way that's reasonably production ready to explore that kind of stuff if any listener is interested about that. And then lately I've been reading about gossip protocols and epidemic algorithms for replicated database maintenance. The algorithms defined in that kind of paper, it's an introduction paper, it's kind of oldish, 1989. It's about usage Xerox about statistical replication and gossip and just randomly messaging peers to be able to replicate data. And that kind of stuff is still useful today. I know for a fact that React started supporting that kind of algorithm as a repair mechanism that's active in the background for the servers since something like January or so. So it's still up to date or relevant today, but it's definitely a nice introduction about what the mechanisms are to do that kind of gossip protocol.
Very cool. And so I have something, it's not really Erlang related, but I saw this video, some guys at the Technion, which is Israel's Institute of Technology up in Haifa, came up with some cool software, and they basically, using a 3D printer and some really cool software, started taking models of M.C. Escher's stuff, some of his, you know, sort of mind geometry bending stuff, and started implementing it in actual, you know, physical form, and it's pretty cool. So I posted I'll post the video and the link to the group. It's all in English, and it's worth watching just for the, oh, this is cool. And I think they even have some of the software, so if you have a 3D printer, you could actually potentially make some of it yourself. So that's my pick. Nothing particularly Erlang related this week. Yeah, nothing particularly Erlang related. Thanks, guys. The next episode will be Brian Hunter will be hosting, because I will be away, and it'll be all about F-sharp and how F-sharp and Erlang learn from each other. So listen for that. And we got a lot more good stuff coming up. Next week's episode, Kevin Hammond from University of Edinburgh will be joining us to talk about University of St. Andrews. My apologies. And then Robert Verding will be joining us later in the month. And Costas Sigonis, we talked about on Dialyzer at the very end of the month, which probably will release early next month. So we got some great stuff coming up, so please subscribe. And if you can leave us a nice review on iTunes, if you enjoy the podcast, we'd really appreciate it. All right. Thanks very much, guys. Talk to you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Have a nice day.